Welcome to Profiles. I'm Shauna Ritter, your host, and our guest is Doug Bowder. Doug is the coordinator of the GLBT Student Support Services Office here at Indiana University. Doug, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Doug, let me ask you, you began as coordinator of the program in 1994, the same year that it started. Talk to me a little bit about how it began and what it was like to be there right at the beginning, in a rather controversial beginning, if I remember correctly.
I don't think I was ever the center of such a storm of controversy. It was quite interesting. And I had come to Bloomington, I guess we'll get a little more into my story later, but I had come here not sure what I was going to be pursuing in terms of a career. But this job was opening as other schools were looking at how to provide support for gay and lesbian students. IU was planning to open this office, in part in response to harassment issues that had come to the Office of Student Ethics, where we're now located. I was one of 80 candidates to apply for the position, as I understood, and they whittled it down to three of us. And just as they were about to make some decisions, the State House was erupting with charges of inappropriateness, and a particular legislator from another part of the state was holding the university hostage to the tune of $500,000, saying, "We will not provide funds for the university if you open this office."
And they were saying it was inappropriate because you were...
Well, they felt the office... One of the arguments was, and I remember very specifically the legislator saying, student services should be provided to minority students who you could tell were minorities by looking at them, like blacks and Jews. That's actually what he said. And someone said, "You mean you can tell someone who's Jewish by looking at them?" And he said, "Yes, but I won't point those people out to you." I mean, that was sort of the thinking.
Those are quotations.
Those are. Those are. We have those on record. And it was like, oh, my goodness. Miles Brand, who was president at that time, realized, I think, the idiocy he was dealing with at the State House and switched the funding from public to private. Practically speaking, it worked to our advantage because it got those legislators off our backs. From a principled standpoint, it was frustrating, but it got the office up and opened. And quite frankly, the first day on the job, I remember thinking there are going to be protesters out here. It'll be very interesting. The only thing that happened in the first hour or two that the office opened was this lovely lady from IU Library stopped by with a bouquet of flowers to say, "We're really glad you're here." Thought, okay, we're off to a good start. But a huge controversy as we opened.
And were the initial charges of inappropriateness because you were serving gay and lesbian and
sure.
bisexual youth?
Right. And the thought was it would be a center for sexual activity. I mean, that wasn't said, but I think there was no sense in which it was an educational resource center or a place of support. In fact, I met with that legislator when we celebrated our 10th anniversary to explain to him what we had been doing the last 10 years. And he gave me enough evidence that there was a little bit of a shift in his thinking, but he still wasn't sure we should be there. When I told him that students were harassed on the campus based on race and religion, gender, and certainly sexual orientation. And so he sort of understood the purpose of being there to support those students. But in terms of educating people about GLBT issues, he didn't see any reason for that at all. So there's still that sentiment, I think, among some in the State House.
That was in the mid-90s.
1994.
How have things changed since then? And have they changed since
well,
then?
Well, that's a great question because certainly we still have people in the State House including this gentleman who believe that, but we also have people who have helped to defeat or to not have sent out of committee legislation regarding preventing gay people to marriage or to marry or to adopt. So we certainly have people who've become advocates for us in the last years. The other change that I note and I talk about all the time in the classroom is the number of students who are straight, who come into the office, who want to be supportive of their gay friends. I speak in a number of classes and ask how many people have gay or lesbian, bi, or even trans friends. Almost everyone raises their hands these days. I wouldn't have even asked that question 10 years ago because people would not have been comfortable indicating that. It's such that's the sea change among the college age group.
So has the gay population multiplied in the last 10 years?
I'm guessing not. I don't think so, Shauna. And that's a fear that some people have. I think we're...
It's a matter of more openness.
I like to think we're a little more honest as a culture.
Tell me a little bit about what you do in your position as coordinator of the Student Support Center.
Sure. It's a fascinating job, and I get to, as I indicated, I get to speak in classes, education classes, sociology, psych classes. They contact the office. We work with the health center to provide education. We do panels and provide information. Education classes in particular, as students say, how can we be sensitive in a relatively conservative atmosphere, maybe a small town or school district? How can we be sensitive to those people, those students who might be gay or lesbian, or those folks who might have gay or lesbian parents or family or friends? How can we create an atmosphere of acceptance? So that's one thing we do on a fairly regular basis. I also work with the Office of Student Ethics to deal with harassment on the campus. And while I think that's diminished somewhat over the years, we don't have as many cases reported to the team that deals with this, and the GLBT anti-harassment team is one of four teams on the campus. There's a gender incidence, a racial incidence, religious incidence bias team. There still are some nasty things that happen on campus. We try and provide support for people harassed, intervention when that is appropriate or is requested, educational forums and things in the residence halls. So those are two small parts of what we do. The other thing is we're able to advocate and support students who come in with class projects. And I think that may be what we do best. 5 years ago, two students, one straight, one gay, came from the Fine Arts Center and said, we have this class project. We'd like to do a mini film festival for an evening. It was a very small effort. We got those students in touch with Danielle McClellan at the Buskirk Chumley. That has since become a major film festival, a Pride Film Festival here in town. So it's taken on
every June, right?
A life of its own. No, actually, it's in January.
It's in January.
Right.
Okay. June is National Pride Month.
Right. Right. But this event has, you know, sort of taken the community by storm. And the Visitors and Convention Bureau support it, and the city supports it. Another great example of a student project was 10 years ago, a student who had worked in the Alumni Association, identified as gay, said, I think we ought to consider having an affiliate group for gay and lesbian alumni. Actually, it's for all alumni who support GLBT causes now. But we started working with the Alumni Association back in 98, 97, I guess, trying to find a way to discover who would be supportive of this effort. And we have 1,000 members across the country now, and one of the most active of close to 30 affiliate groups as part of the Alumni Association. So some of these projects are short-lived. It's just a class project, a paper that's being written. But so we're a research center. We're a place where people can both develop programs. We're planning a big conference next year, which we can talk a little bit about if you choose to, a major event, which 30 or 40.
National conference, right?
Yes. Well, I guess it's more regional, but I know people in the past have come from Canada and from the coast, but it's called the Midwest BLGTA College Conference. 1,500 to 1,800 students will be with us.
Can you decode all the?
Just a mixing of the LGBT, and A is for ally, meaning straight students are also welcome. And that, again, is a sign of the change that's happened. The conference we went to in Minnesota, Champaign-Urbana this last year, number of straight students who just want to be supportive of their gay friends and want to learn more about issues like gay marriage and political and religious issues related to sexual orientation, gender identity.
Let me ask you, Doug, you began your professional life as a minister.
I did.
How does this job compare to your job or vocation as a minister?
Some of my students will tell you that I still end up preaching on occasion to them.
Do your kids say the same thing?
No, actually, they usually preach to me. I tell many, many people that my kids have raised an amazing father. They're both 30 now, 30 and 31, so that's a whole other story. But one of the ways these intersect, and I remember the day of the interview for this position, Dick McKay, who's dean of students, of course, was curious to know how I would handle, and he threw out a scenario of dealing with someone with religious conflicts regarding this issue, and apparently the way I responded to that question was helpful. I knew it was an important issue. Many students who come into the office struggle with coming out to family, integrating spirituality and sexuality. On more occasions than I can mention to you, I think having a pastoral sense, just a caring way of approaching, but also some understanding of what the Bible says or doesn't say about this issue has been really, really helpful. I also think the particular tradition out of which I come is a very inclusive, perhaps one of the more inclusive approaches to Christianity historically. Not as welcoming and inclusive as I would like them to be of GLBT issues, but I think I've been of some help to the denomination in that regard. But historically, a denomination that really values other cultures and even other religions. So I grew up in a tradition where we weren't denigrating other Christians or non-Christians or people of other races. It wasn't until I moved away from my home and went to seminary and then took on a job in Wisconsin where I realized there's a lot of racism. I mean, I knew of that as I was growing up, but I experienced that, you know, anti-Semitism, racism, divisions within the Christian church that didn't make a lot of sense to me because that was not part of the tradition I grew up in. We were really very respectful of other traditions.
Is that the way the scriptures are interpreted or the culture and climate of the community or the intersection
yes.
of those?
Yes, to both. I mean, it's an intersection. I think it's a misinterpretation of scripture. And again, culture encourages people to do that all the time, I think. So I feel very fortunate, again, growing up in a family and a faith tradition that was very respectful of other people, of people who were different. So that's helped a great deal because I've been involved in issues on the campus beyond GLBT issues. Issues of race are very important to me, and I think I recognize how often that harkens back to the faith tradition in which I grew up.
You're listening to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Doug Bowder, the coordinator of the GLBT Student Support Center at Indiana University in Bloomington. You began studying ministry in the early 70s, if I remember correctly, Doug.
That's correct.
And you went to university during the tumultuous late 60s. What pulled you in to the ministry and to pursue that vocation?
That's fascinating. It actually had something to do, again, with, I think, my own sense of justice, social justice. Again, the church I grew up in, it's called the Moravian Church, is not necessarily in the forefront of all sorts of social justice issues. But because we're a worldwide denomination, the church has dealt in various countries with issues like apartheid and, various global issues that helped me to be conscious of issues of justice as a young boy, as I would hear people speak in our church and whatever. One of the young men who from seminary was our youth pastor was very influential in my life. And in the 60s, when all these social issues were hot and I was in college, I, again, was fortunate enough to be a part of a faith tradition that was addressing those issues. I lived in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania at that time. I can remember my pastor going to march and demonstrations in D.C. against the war in Vietnam, was very vocal about issues of race in our community. And so, again, I saw a coming together of issues of social justice and faith among someone I really respected. I was thinking of a career in politics or social work. I think I was planning to go into the Peace Corps, which was just coming into its own in the 60s. So that was sort of my first thought, and I was actually avoiding ministry because some of the folks I saw in seminary were all about being pious and sort of religious, with quotes, but I didn't see them committed to social justice issues. And when I realized that one could bring those issues together, I realized, again, people were affirming some of my gifts, that I had good speaking abilities, I had a caring heart. It seemed like that maybe is the direction I should head. So that was sort of how all that came together in college.
So you really viewed ministry as a vehicle for change, if this is a fair way to
sure.
say, rather than a way to maintain tradition, or both?
Yeah, change probably, again, in the 60s, more important than tradition, although I greatly valued the traditions that I grew up in. And, that's a really tough question, because it wasn't so much either or, but I think the fact that calling for change, which certainly I think is part of the Reformation tradition, out of which, again, our Protestant denomination grew, there's always need for change. We're always needing to challenge each other. But some of those traditions, which I grew up with, and maybe we'll talk about that in terms of the music, are also wonderfully comforting. And so it's that balance of being challenged and being comforted and finding some sort of middle space, I guess, that the richness, again, of that tradition did a little bit of both for me.
Speaking of music, I wanted to listen to the Three Chorales by Antis, and this is a piece that you chose. Doug, why did you choose this piece?
I heard this from my childhood, the High Holy Days in our tradition, Christmas and Easter. In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, there was this wonderful trombone choir that would herald the holidays. And so this sound, this mellow, lovely, sweet, sort of solemn sound, brings to my mind my approach to worship, my understanding of who God is. It just represents all sorts of things. And I think one of the pieces I chose, I hadn't thought about the words of it, come from an anthem that's "What Splendid Rays of Truth and Light." And I love the thought that again, out of light and truth comes this wonderful awareness and approach to the world. But it's the sound that sort of harkens me back to my faith tradition.
Performed by?
By the Los Angeles Symphony Brass Choir, I believe it is.
We've been listening to Three Chorales by Antis, and we are speaking with Doug Bowder, the coordinator of the GLBT Student Support Center. Doug, I have read a little bit about your biography, and you refer to an era as the dark night of your soul, when you realized you had to make some very big changes in your life. Can you talk a little bit about...
Sure.
What that was like for you? You were in the ministry, you were married, you had two young children.
Yes.
We're in the mid-70s, I believe.
I was married in the mid-70s. This was actually the early 80s. So 5 years into a marriage, I realized that what I had spoken to my now former wife about prior to our marriage was more of a reality than I realized. I had actually confessed to her. She's the only person I'd ever spoken to about what I described at that time, now 30 years ago, as my fears and fantasies. I had never had an intimate sexual experience with a woman. All my fantasies were same gender oriented. And I didn't understand this, and I hadn't talked about it to anyone, but I felt this might be a barrier in our marriage. We were both very naive, and because we loved each other, and still do, I might add, we have a wonderful friendship now. We went on with the marriage. This was, again, the mid-70s, the year after the American Psychological or Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from its list of mental disorders. And I remember noting that, but still not identifying as a gay man in the 70s. One of the theories in those days, and I guess among some people still, is that homosexuality is an arrested stage of development. I wanted so much to believe that. I wanted to believe that this would go away when I found the right woman, when, you know, we developed a full and loving relationship. And that wasn't to be. And then I felt trapped and scared. and remember, quite frankly, being very close to a nervous breakdown. It was a very scary time because I was pastor of a fairly large church in Green Bay, Wisconsin. It was just a horrible time. The stress of being a relatively new parent, responsible for a congregation. I just reflected on this fairly recently, and it was just a very, very scary time. I considered suicide when we finally decided to divorce. It almost broke my soul. But again, there was something about that faith tradition in which I had grown up that helped me to go even deeper into believing that I was a worthwhile human being, that I could come to understand this issue better, and that being honest was important. And ultimately, I think that honesty not only helped me in my relationship with my former wife, but my own children, who today are some of my strongest supporters. Initially, again, it was really difficult.
Did you give up ministry at that point?
I took the denomination was very supportive of me, and I think their understanding was somehow or other I would come to terms with this and maybe discover that I wasn't gay, but that I needed some time to heal. The divorce in itself was traumatic, and so they encouraged me to take some time off, and I took a year, sought some very good counsel from someone who became a dear friend. He was part of the American Council on Religion and Psychiatry in Green Bay, and was very, very helpful in terms of looking at this issue and understanding it. And ultimately, I came to accept the fact that I was gay, and soon after that, there was an opening in another Moravian church, and I took that position as a pastor. Now, they didn't hire me as a gay pastor. They didn't know all that I had been struggling with. But within a few years after taking on that job, I came out, and this was a small rural congregation in southern Wisconsin. It's a love story all its own, just an amazing level of acceptance after they had gotten to know me and I had been their pastor for a few years. I shared what I was now really claiming as the truth in my life, and they were fine with it. It was just an amazing experience. But in time, I decided I needed to do more with this issue, and part of it was related to the suicide of someone in my previous congregation in Green Bay who I'm pretty sure was struggling with his own sexual orientation. And that was the sort of culminating moment for me in terms of I need to be more honest still about this issue. I need to help the church. I need to help our society come to grips with this. People should not be taking their lives over this.
And is that part of the motivation why mm-hmm. you've become so public
Absolutely.
In speaking about your own struggle?
Absolutely. Yep. I recall two memories of Paul. One was going into a nursing home with a youth group, and if you've ever done that with young people who are brand new to this situation, the smells and the sounds in a nursing home can be pretty frightening. And I remember this group of students sort of huddling around me and one woman off in the corner making a rather loud sounds and rocking in her wheelchair. Paul went over and spoke to her and touched her on the arm and just cared for her in a just an amazingly sensitive way. That's one memory I have of him. Another was a bus to a youth conference in another state where he just had everyone laughing the whole trip. He was just this amazingly sensitive and thoughtful and funny young man who'd be doing some community a great service today, whatever he'd be doing. In his second year in college, he drove off campus, hooked a rubber hose to his exhaust pipe, put it into his car, rolled up his windows, ended his life. No one understood why in the world he would do this. I began to think about conversations where he had where he was indicating a struggle that he couldn't even name, and I'm sure it was, I think I might be gay, and he could never say those words. I think about Paul all the time and realize that's still a reality for some people out there.
Is that struggle, do you think, for high school students and for students in college or for young people who are not involved in any educational system, who are out working and coming to terms
yeah.
with who they are, you think that struggle still exists as
yeah.
strongly?
Yeah, and I don't think it's as prominent as it used to be. I think there are more resources out there. We are more aware of this issue. I take a little bit of credit for that. Again, I mean, I think the work that we do on this campus is really important for families, for individuals. But yes, I think the reality is still there.
Support for Profiles comes from Smithfield Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithfield Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. You're listening to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Doug Bowder. Doug, you were speaking about some of the struggles that especially young people still go through in terms of their own sexual identity. And where do you think the root of really feeling it be such a challenge and so difficult to claim one's sexual identity when it's not straight comes from?
That's a really tough question to answer. I think a lot of it still comes from bad religion. I'm currently reading a book by Mel White called Religion Gone Bad. And I think the influence of religion on a person's life, particularly fundamentalist religion, that is very narrow and defines people in a particular way, just has lasting impact. And the authority of that influence is still very strong. So to come to college, to think beyond a narrow interpretation of faith, to try and redefine one's faith is no easy task. And so I think that's a large part of it. I think, you know, politically speaking, we still have a lot of people who are opposed to any kind of rights for gay and lesbian people. So you still have major institutions in this culture sending messages to young people that you should not be this way. While, again, there are more role models of people who are gay and lesbian, leading productive and positive lives, there are not enough of them. And there are still too many messages that are being conveyed by people in authority, whether it's the Pope or the President, saying this is wrong. And we have a ways to go to, I think, deal with that negative energy.
As you came to terms with your own sexuality, what are some of the places that you drew strength from? You've mentioned your faith really sustained you. Where else did you draw strength?
I want to say something more about faith, because I can remember sitting down with one of the bishops in our church, and the memory came to me very recently where we had this conversation, and I finally acknowledged to this man that I thought I was gay, and he looked at me and he said, "Doug, that's one of life's dynamics." And I said, "Milo, that's not the way the church sees this issue, as one of life's dynamics." He said, "I know, and it saddens me that we haven't come to an understanding that that's all it is. Maybe you can help us with that." Well, I couldn't even hear the challenge to be that person at that point. But the non-judgmental, loving way, this one man who I respected a great deal spoke to me, that was huge. So it was people like that who helped a great deal. There was also this sort of amazing amount of literature that was being written from the mid-70s on. As I again look back on my life, there was very little that was being written positively before the 70s. All of a sudden, you had theologians, psychologists, after that decision in 74 was reached by the American Psychological Association, Psychiatric Association, you had lots of information being written. So I was privy to a lot of that. I remember when I was living in the Madison, Wisconsin area, joining a gay father's support group. And it was just a wonderful group of men, some of them who were still in a marriage, some who had left the marriage but were working at raising their children, being good fathers. So there were a number of resources, again, that I sort of felt fortunate, blessed to find at a time when I needed that. The very fact that I had moved from Green Bay, which was a pretty heterosexual, macho community.
Football town.
But you know, again, dealing with that issue in that community was not the easiest thing. I've since met Sarah Tuala, who played for the Packers, a gay NFL football player who's wonderful, and that's been fun. But moving from Green Bay down to the Madison area, where there was this wonderfully liberal community, was providential? I don't know, but there I ended up in this part of the state where there was a supportive community, and a number of my colleagues in ministry and new friends were just a great gift to me.
Can I ask you how your family reacted?
Yeah, sure. initially my my wife was feeling trapped and frustrated and angry, perhaps somewhat guilty herself that she hadn't been all that she could be as a wife. And so that was one set of reactions, and we were able to deal with that with some good counsel and over time. My kids, as I tell the story, my son, who was just 4 or 5, and I was needing to make some changes in our weekends together because I was intending to write a study guide for our church, I was explaining that I was going to not see them one weekend when we normally would have. And Courtney said, "What?" I told them I was going to be writing this study guide, and they said, "What are you writing about, Daddy?" And I said, "Well, it's about sexuality and spirituality." And actually, we had talked very openly with the kids as they were growing up about how babies are made and that sort of thing. But we had also addressed issues of appropriate words. And they had heard the word faggot, and we had talked about the fact this is not a word. So they knew a little bit about gay issues. And I said, I'm going to be writing about what it means to be gay and be Christian. And that was a point at which I then came out to them. And all my son asked about was, "Who knows this, Daddy?" He wondered whether he had to keep it a secret. And I said, "Everyone who's important to us knows this." So that was kind of a relief for him. And as time went on, he got into his adolescent years. He struggled a little more, less than my daughter did. But in time came full circle and, again, is one of my strongest supporters. My parents were amazing. They were willing to find resources to help me because I was so torn apart about this. And they... Mother is an educator. She's a librarian, still living in Bethlehem. Had some resources to suggest. My dad, who is just an ordinary sort of steelworker kind of guy, but with a very loving heart, just listened to me and asked good questions and was my strongest supporter. So I was very, very fortunate, as well as were my sisters and their one truck-driving brother-in-law and, one who works in an art museum. Again, this family that had been nurturing for me was at their very best at this moment. So I was fortunate, and that's not the experience of a lot of people still today. Again, I had these special opportunities that I felt I need to use the support I've been given and pay it forward.
And what are some of the ways other than your actual job in which you find yourself paying it forward?
Well, I also try and be involved in the larger community, not just, what I get paid for at Indiana University. You might know a little bit about the work of Bloomington United, which over the years has tried to respond to issues of hate in the community, whether it's anti-Semitism or racism. The shooting of Won Jun-yoon some years ago, almost 10 years ago now. Mm-hmm. I've gotten very caught up in those kinds of issues. I worked on the Human Rights Commission for 6 or 7 years. I actually worked at Stonebelt before I started at the university. I think my concern for people who are often downtrodden or oppressed is directly related to understanding something of my experience as a gay man. And so I try and find ways in my spare time in the community to support causes. My son and I are both active members of the Southern Poverty Law Center and had an opportunity to be there for the dedication of their new Civil Rights Museum a few years ago, the very weekend that Rosa Parks died. We were in her museum. So both on a local level and more nationally, those are the causes I support, things I try and do with my time. And in the process, I've met some of Bloomington's most wonderful people. You know, Mira Wasserman at Beth Shalom, Beverly Calendar Anderson at the Safe and Civil Cities. These are people who are dear friends of mine, people who work in the cultural centers here in Bloomington. This is such a wonderful community. And I feel, again, how did I end up here? How did this happen?
What feeds you, Doug, besides the work that you do for social justice and the work that you do in the center? What's something that continues to feed you?
Springtime in Bloomington, music, singing. I'm in both the church choir that I'm a member at St. Thomas Lutheran Church. I sing in the choir. That's a ritual. Both Thursday night choir practices and Sunday morning worship is part of the cycle of my week, and that feeds me. coming away from that experience and contributing to creating, even if just for a couple moments, some harmony in the community or in the congregation. I feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and singing in the choir line men's chorus.
And we're going to listen to Anything Is Possible by Fred Small, sung by the Quarryland Men's Chorus. Tell me a little bit about the chorus before we listen
sure.
to this.
This is a group of us got together almost 5 years ago now, thinking it would be a great, I think appropriate word is witness to the community, to have men who love to sing, gay men and straight men, join their voices together and have fun singing. And so we formed this men's chorus that's largely a group of gay men, but we have some wonderful straight allies who sing with us because they love singing. And we just have fun, do two major concerts during the year. We sing at the farmer's market every year. We've sung at Martin Luther King Day, Interfaith Service, some other events, Positive Link. We've sung for them to raise money for AIDS walks and things like that. So it's, again, it brings my worlds together, social justice, good music, and great friends.
And why this song, Everything's Possible?
Wow. I heard this song in my own coming out process, and it just made me weep. And I shared it with my partner as we were just coming together, and he was sharing some of the heartache in his life. And I said, Marty, I wish your mother had sung this song to you when you were a little boy.
We have cleared off the table, the leftovers saved, washed the dishes and put them away. I have told you a story and tucked you in tight at the end of your knockabout day. As the moon sets its sail to carry you to sleep over the midnight sea, I will sing you a song no one sang to me. May it keep you good company. You can be anybody that you want to be. You can love whomever you will. You can travel.
We've been listening to Everything's Possible by Fred Small, sung by the Quarryland's Men's Chorus. Doug, you mentioned your partner, and you moved to Bloomington because of your partner. Talk to me a little bit about that move and what brought you here, what made you decide to shift locations and lives to some degree.
Yeah, wow. Everything in my life was satisfying except missing that give and take of sharing your life with someone. I was very pleased with the way my kids were growing up. I felt I was contributing to their lives. I loved my job as a pastor. I was working both as a pastor and at that point in time a hospital chaplain in Madison. I was anticipating a move into hospital chaplaincy at a time when I met my partner. And he had just moved to Bloomington. I had visited here once or twice. I have this image of daffodils in the snow. That was my first image of Bloomington, one February when the daffodils were blooming. And I fell in love with this community at the same time that I fell in love with Marty. I was anticipating a change in my career, was planning on a move into either hospice work or hospital chaplaincy, and decided I would relocate. I really wanted to enter into this relationship. I felt Marty and I had a future together, and I took a risk, probably the biggest risk in my life, that has paid amazing dividends. Marty and I have been together 15 years. He, too, is a father. We have learned so much from each other. He happens to be Jewish. I'm Christian. He grew up in Chicago. I grew up in a small steel town in Bethlehem. There's lots about us that's very different. He's on the faculty at the School of Informatics. I hardly know how to do email. There's so many things about us that are different, but our values and our respect and love for each other is very strong, and I feel very, very fortunate to be able to share my life with him.
What are some things that you think is absolutely key for family members and friends to be aware of as they are trying to support someone who's coming out?
Everyone needs to do it at their own pace. It's a discovery process, and I know there are still those out there who think being gay is a choice. It is not a choice. One chooses at some point in time to be honest about who they really believe themselves to be. But, it really is a discovery process. I'm thinking of a mother who bumped into me at our summer orientation. We have a resource center at the main library here on campus, and I get to relate to parents all the time as they walk by our table with a rainbow flag and students. It's just a great opportunity, and I'm thinking of this mother who said, "I have a son who's gay, but he doesn't know it yet." And I thought that was sort of funny. And she said, "Oh, my gosh, he's across the room and he sees me talking to you right now." And she was flustered. And she was a psychologist. And I said, "Well, maybe today's the day to talk." I said, "You could just tell him we're talking shop. But maybe today's the day to raise the question." I don't say that lightly, because I think if you suspect your son or daughter is different, what's important is you've created an environment in your home where your child is going to be loved and respected, whoever they are. And they'll find their own way and time to do that. I know people who've come out in elementary school. I know people who are still hesitating to share with their parents that they're gay or lesbian. And they're going to wait till they graduate from college so that their financial support isn't cut off. So it really varies. But I would say, do your best to create an environment where whoever your son or daughter is, whatever your expectations are for them, make sure they're following their truth. And help them to, create an environment, go see movies, have discussions, encourage them to read books that will open them to a world where they can fit in that's not so restricted. I also want to mention another mother who that same summer came up to me and said, "I'm so glad to see IU has these resources. This is wonderful." And she looked me in the eye and she said, "My son is so homophobic, I don't know where I've gone wrong. I feel like a failure. He just doesn't get it. He's so dumb about this issue." And I said to her, somewhat with tongue in cheek, "Maybe I'll have a gay roommate." And she looked at me and said, "That would be good." It's interesting. Here, the mom was the one who was frustrated that her son was homophobic. But that points to the fact that homophobia isn't just a problem for the closeted gay kid. That young man is his life is going to be richer when he gets to know his gay roommate or whatever. And I've seen that happen on this campus. I've seen wonderful friendships develop when people discover, "Oh, this person isn't exactly like I thought he was," or, So again, but it's in answer to your question, I think it's a very individual journey, and creating that space. I have two little grandsons right now, one who's 3 years old. He loves watching Dancing with the Stars. I don't mean to suggest he's going to be gay, but you know what his parents are going to do? They're going to let him sign up for dancing lessons. How wonderful. He might end up being a football player. I don't know. But right now they're recognizing that he has a passion and a love for something, and they're letting him explore that. Mm-hmm. That's a great example to me.
Let me ask you, too, if within the realm of the support center or within the realm of your own work, you've worked on some of the very public issues around gay marriage and civil union, and how you see those things and how you see them relating back to how we accept or support people's sexual orientation and people's individuality.
I'm kind of a political animal, and I certainly have favorite candidates and all of that. As an office, we try not to be too politically engaged, but there clearly are a lot of students who want to take the lead on these issues. And I think it's really important to, again, support them in their learning process of how to work within the political system. And so there have been some wonderful opportunities to do those over the years. I have certainly, again, spoken out when there are questions about political issues from a people perspective. I have a wealth of stories about individuals who are amazing parents, two men in this community who have foster parented just an incredible number of children and do just such a good job. I will tell stories to legislators or write stories in letters to legislators. I tend not to be so much an in-your-face protester, But for those students who want to do that, I encourage them to express their outrage at some of the idiocy that's out there and, again, to call for justice. So I think working within the political system is really important.
How do you keep that balance between some of the things that are out there mm-hmm. and the outrage and finding peace, balance, and a place to just be in your own daily life?
Yeah. Well, I've helped maybe to create that place to be for myself because I know there are other like-minded people out there. And so I find those folks. I find that faith community. I find that circle of friends to give me hope. Again, music does that for me. Living in this community, walking across the campus or taking a walk in the woods, I really find various ways to center my own soul and believe that the job that we're doing is part of our calling as God's people to make the world better. But we have a long way to go. But I believe in hope. And I look beyond the ugliness and the hatred that's here and believe there's something that's stronger than that. And that's what I work towards.
If I was to look at your night table where you have your books or your coffee table in your living room where you have your books, what would I find you reading right now?
Oh, what a great question. Both of Barack Obama's books, one which I loaned to my son recently. I have a book called To Life by Rabbi Kushner. Because I've been asked, and I feel, again, so fortunate to conduct the wedding of my partner's son later this year. He's asked me to do that, and I want a fuller appreciation of what it means to be Jewish. And so I'm reading Rabbi Kushner's book. Bloom Magazine is on our coffee table. I love reading that and again, valuing and appreciating the community that we're in. I think I have Bill Clinton's Giving book on our coffee table right now. Nelson Mandela had a place on our coffee table for a while. And the current book I mentioned a little earlier that I'm reading is called Religion Gone Bad. So religion, politics, the arts.
Biographies.
Yeah, those are what I love to do.
Tell me one thought you'd like to leave people with as they're listening to this. And they're thinking about GLBT issues. They're thinking about you as an individual and your personal journey and how faith, religion, and working for social justice come together.
I think I believe change really can happen, and I've seen that enough in my lifetime. I think in reference to the last song we might listen to, that I really believe much of the world is beautiful. People can be good if you help them to find the truth. I've seen narrow-minded, hateful people change their own attitudes in time when someone they love comes out to them and they have to do a 180-degree shift, but their love is stronger than their ignorance or their fear or whatever it is. And so I guess helping people to find that core and sometimes I have to walk away and say it's not going to happen in this person or I'm not going to be the person to create this change. But you keep doing what you can to open people to that, I think, that source that's out there that wants us to live together, to love each other, to see the beauty in the world.
You've been listening to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Doug Bowder. Doug, thanks so much for being with us.
What a joy to be here. Thank you.
We're going to listen to What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. And I think Doug explained why he chose that song. Anything else you want to say about it, Doug?
Nope. Just listen and enjoy.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
The program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.